Well, thank you. I'm a retired Fed, a 15-year cancer survivor. I'm probably the most unsupervised speaker you're going to hear all session, all conference. And what we'd like to do is talk about public health politics in a deeper way. There's the political froth that we, you know, have up on the surface of the water, and we see in the, you know, 13-member political debates, and then there the various waves that sort of break over us from time to time. But there's a much deeper level of currents running through this. And we're taking this session is built around Jonathan Haidt's 2012 book, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Cannot Agree on Politics and Religion. Anybody familiar with Haidt's work? A few, one or two. Okay, your names will be taken. And this is, so we're doing a book report then today, okay? The work that Jonathan Haidt has done certainly has changed my view of public health politics in a way. And it's a little bit like that 2x2 matrix, which I will use a little later, of, you know, there are things you know, and there are things you weren't aware that you knew. You knew them, you weren't aware of. And then there are things you know good and well you don't know. And then there's that fourth block of areas that you are not aware you don't know. And what Haidt has done to me is open up a door politically at something I didn't know exists. And he provides a convincing message that it's quite real. So I've done this presentation a couple of times with both Scott Burris and Sulin Ledford. Scott teaches at the Temple School of Law, and we were parallel evolution. He was developing a course around Haidt's work and teaching it in the law school as I was doing it in the School of Public Health. Scott also does the Robert Wood Johnson grants, one for public health law research, and just standing up a new one on a National Coordinating Center for Policies for Action. And so we've done some of this before. Sulin Ledford is the health director for Wake County, Raleigh, North Carolina, the largest local health department in the state. And she has helped me on presentations on this by giving the voice of how Haidt's work appears from a conservative perspective. And it really helps map out what it was I didn't know very well. Sue Lynn in Western North Carolina ran in a Republican state primary, lost by 120 votes to a more conservative Teabag candidate. But she is a very persuasive voice in the state in how to try to accomplish political goals. There is no doubt of her total commitment to public health. And I find having her on a panel is very enriching to this type of discussion. So what we're going to do for about 30 minutes, the three of us are going to kind of tag team different aspects of this, really, this domain that to me is that fourth domain, we didn't know we didn't know area. And then we will open this up for hopefully 30 minutes of discussion. I have never had an audience not fill all the time available to engage on this topic. We will talk politics. That's the greatest part about being unsupervised on this. So let me, and I guess we've got disclaimers here that have to get out of the way, and we don't have anything to disclose, and our family doesn't want to know we're here. Scott, you want to take it, do the setup, and we're going to tag team. Don't worry about it.
Well, good morning. It's a real pleasure to be here. I have a relationship to disclose. My wife is here with me in Chicago. And last night we took advantage of being here and not having to worry about kids or any chores. We went to see a movie. We saw the Steve Jobs movie. How many of you have seen that Steve Jobs movie? That's good. Then I can tell you anything I want to about it. There's a scene, as portrayed in this movie, Steve Jobs tends to get angry at people and hold grudges and engage in pretty elaborate conspiracy theorizing. And at the heart of the movie is a thing that happens right at the beginning. He looks at the cover of Time magazine that doesn't have him on it draws all sorts of conclusions from what he sees on that cover about who's attacking him and who's against him, and that runs throughout the entire movie. And just at the end, somebody points out to him that he didn't actually see what he thought he saw, that he missed, he failed to observe what was actually there, and instead had imagined something that was there that was consistent with whatever was going on in his mind at the time. Now, that kind of summarizes what we've learned, pretty much everything we've learned about psychology in the last 30, 40 years. You can't trust your brain. You think that you see accurately. You think that there's nothing better than eyewitness testimony, for example. You think you can believe your eyes, and you can't. That's just clear. Right? There's not a whole lot of dispute about that. Right? What happens instead is that our brains, which were programmed originally to jump really fast if something rustled in the grass behind us, and to worry about whether it really was a snake or a lion later, those brains continue to work that way. They continue to develop constantly causal stories that give order to the chaos around us. They rule out things to pay attention to, and they rule in other things that we have to pay attention to. They construct a world constantly that makes sense, which is problematic to the extent that the world around us frequently doesn't make sense, and the causal stories don't fit together, and you actually don't have Steve Jobs, the enemies you think you have. The people that you think are stabbing you in the back are actually trying to straighten your jacket. But nonetheless, we live in that world of what we create rather than the world of all the things that we're failing to observe. Now, these are obviously necessary. They help us do all sorts of basic tasks to get through the world. But they do create systematic bias and error in our perceptions of the world. That's the sort of basic heuristics and biases stuff that won the psychologist Daniel Kahneman the Nobel Prize for economics. That's a long story, but nonetheless, Nobel is Nobel. And he's continued to write a lot of interesting stuff about that, and it's been very important all throughout economics and psychology. What Haidt does is take that same understanding of mental processes, of the fact that we use shortcuts and have sort of settled structures already preloaded in our brains, and applies it to moral reasoning. And actually, as I note here, that's kind of a polite term, because what he's really talking about is moral intuition. Like the way we call to mind recent events and try and assess probability, or like we fit details onto an eyewitness situation that weren't actually there but fit with our story, so with our moral judgments, we start actually with a set of preloaded moral conclusions that we apply to new situations, and we do that automatically, so fast that we don't realize it. So we think, when presented with a moment for moral judgment, that we very quickly run through our mind right and wrong. We balance beneficence and maleficence and this and that, and then we sort of come to a reasoned understanding, oh yes, that's bad. But in fact, what we do is take one look, know how we feel, and then our brain kicks in to explain why that's really a good way to feel, and why anyone who doesn't feel that way, like us, has got some terrible blind spot, just doesn't understand something. And what that process leads to is the battle of press agents. My press agent explains to you why you're a complete idiot for not already understanding the right and wrong here, and then your press agent argues to me why I'm a complete idiot for not understanding the obvious thing that's as plain as the nose on my face. And you just kind of argue louder and louder and louder and louder until you're satisfied that you've done your moral work, and you look at each other in disgust and walk off. This is built into us. In Haidt's model, this is a product. He's an evolutionary psychologist, or that's what he calls himself, and he understands what's happened here in very similar terms that the psychologists understand how we developed our rapid factual processing parts of our brain. And that is that, you know, 50,000 years ago, 40,000 years ago, as people started to live together in groups, there was tension, right? We needed to find ways to work together. We needed sort of social software that would allow us to function effectively collectively. And we needed that to work fast. We didn't want to sit down. I mean, you've all been in those committees, right, where you have to decide on everything. Let's start with the shape of the table, and then we'll start with, you know, how we should arrange ourselves around the table, etc. You know, you need to get past that, have some things that are just built in that you don't have to worry about. So he uses the metaphor for the way this plays out in our behavior, the metaphor of the elephant and the rider. Right? So the elephant is our intuition, and the rider is our rational thinking. Right away, there's a scale issue. As you can see, there's a strength issue. Guess which one tells us where to go. You know, the rider can kind of kick on one side or another. The rider can kind of pull on the ear and try and get the elephant to slow down. But basically, the elephant pretty much goes where it wants to go. And so when the rider can kind of work with the elephant, you know, when we can get a little time to slow the elephant down, he calls it getting the elephant to lean. If we can just catch the elephant's interest, then sometimes the rider can get some control. And then sometimes you actually can have a rational introspection and a rational conversation about your beliefs. But, you know, you are still fundamentally facing the fact that you've got a very big animal driving your reactions. The hope here, as I alluded to, is that this came from these moral intuitions didn't come from really the individual evolutionary process. It came from the group evolutionary process. So he's a disciple of Wilson, and, you know, believes that groups evolve and compete just like individuals do, and that although we're mostly, as he calls us, chimps, individuals trying to maximize the future of our own genes, we are chimps who live in hives. And the success of the hive is directly related and instrumental to the success of our individual ability to push forward our genes. So we have to also be able to work together, because groups that are defined by morality that helps them cohere, helps them cooperate, and helps avoid conflict are groups that are going to be able to work more successfully in the competition with other groups. So we as individuals have evolved both self-serving behaviors and beliefs and attitudes, but also we developed the capacity to be very altruistic and to serve the group. And where that happens is in these moral intuitions. And so as we start to think about what that means for persuasion, the key here is to begin to understand more fully what those moral intuitions are and how we can speak to them. And that's when I pass it over to Gene.
Thank you. So let's consider then what Jonathan Haidt is really saying here. And go back to the 2x2 matrix, okay? I know, you know, the A squared plus B squared equals C squared for a right triangle, okay? You know, last week I was able to fix a garage door, electronic garage door. I didn't know I knew how to do it, but I did. Maybe it was dumb luck, but I fixed it. I was not aware I knew how. Okay, there are things that I know I don't know. My office administrative staff and I both know I should not be let loose anywhere near a Excel spreadsheet, okay? I will sabotage it, okay? Not something I know. But then there's this fourth domain over here of not being aware what I don't know. And this is what Haidt helps us drill down into. There's a book that came out in 2004 by Thomas Frank, What's the Matter with Kansas, that some of you might be familiar with that, that talked about how Kansas evolved from a traditionally 100% blue state, liberal state, after the Civil War. And over about the last 50, 40, 30 years, it has consistently shifted with each crisis from a politically liberal state to a politically conservative state. And Thomas Frank in the book sort of left it open as to what it was. Why has this shift occurred? And there's sort of a conspiracy theory that it is because of the noise machines from the political right are fooling the Kansas farmers to vote against their economic interest, which is what the liberal agenda is, and for this other conservative agenda. I will come back. I will put Kansas up here on a peg and come back to that. Let's talk about what Height does real quickly. Height lays out six moral foundations that help us take those shortcuts of, is that rustling in the grass back there a snake or a mole? Okay? And he lays them out sort of in pairs. Care and harm, liberty oppression, fairness cheating, loyalty betrayal, authority subversion, and sanctity degradation. So let me break those apart in two sets of three real quickly. Okay? Care and harm. It reflects the base of Maslow's pyramid, our hierarchy of needs. We need food, shelter, warmth, a cave to be in to keep the predators away, etc. Okay? Liberty oppression. Physical and mental freedom, psychological freedom. And you start getting into the inversions of each of those. The social intolerance of bullies. Okay? We don't like bullies. And, you know, Jane Goodall's chimpanzees show that a bully in a tribe will get attacked and driven away as a leader. Okay? Third, fairness and cheating. The equity and equality of opportunities, which we all believe in. But also there's a social intolerance of free riders. So I spent some time out in Micronesia on small atolls. And, you know, different culture, a little bit more fundamental culture where you act collectively. The women help prepare the food, and the men go out and fish and harvest the coconuts. And if you don't harvest your fair share of coconuts or go out and fish, you can get voted off the island in a way that really isn't too pleasant. You know? So we are hardwired not to tolerate free riders. Okay, and the other three, loyalty and betrayal. Personal trust, we identify by groups, football teams or whatever, patriotism falls into that. You know, we have sort of many concentric circles. And the inversion of that is we will socially isolate those who betray us. We don't like betrayers. Authority and subversion. You know, our ancestors found there was that competitive advantage of living in the hive, living in the social organized group. And we defer to good leaders, okay? The Alexander the Great, who was able to assimilate various tribes, make them part of his team and go on and conquer the world. We are intolerant of those who subvert the system, okay? If you're not part of the team, if you're subverting this organized hive structure, we do not tolerate that. And finally, sanctity degradation. Now, Height does really a great job of not getting caught into the religious aspects of this. It is there, it is part of it, but that's not the dominant conversation. It's the respect for the transcendental nature of the human spirit. We all touch upon that in our lives. And the inversion is, we have social aversion of personal degradation. Okay? We find that revolting. Okay? So those are the six foundations. Now, what Haidt did, this was work he began at University of Virginia and at UPenn. He found out that these moral indices, these foundational values, can be reliably measured. And so he first did a cohort around Philadelphia, and then he went off on a sabbatical to India, and he did work there. Of course, the profile was different. And then he went to South America, did another set of profiles. And the scores on all of these various indices were different. So then he came back to the United States and did an in-depth study of a qualified sample of a U.S. population. And he found the most interesting thing is that in the U.S., in the dealing with these moral values, these intuitive foundational values, there was a difference along the political spectrum. And so for liberals, their moral matrix, their most sacred value, is care of victims of oppression. And the scores are high on those first three values, care, liberty, and fairness. And liberals score lower on loyalty, authority, and sanctity. Now, I will stipulate by my observation of 25 years at CDC and 10 years doing work at UNC, that public health tends to clump around this profile. Okay? Humor me here. So then there's a different profile for political conservatives. The most sacred value is to preserve the institutions and traditions of the moral community, preserving our community. Okay? And what's interesting, and these are my adaptations from Haidt. He has visuals, but they're a little too tedious for a quick presentation. These are mine. Political conservatives in the U.S. score, as we would might guess, they score high on loyalty, authority, and sanctity, but they score almost as high on the first three values as U.S. political liberals score. Okay? Well, that makes for a real interesting triple play here. Okay? First of all, if you cast the liberals, they would predict they score high here and low here. Okay? They would incorrectly predict that conservatives score low on these first three values and then high on loyalty, authority, and sanctity. They would misperceive. Okay? But if you poll conservatives in the U.S., they would correctly say, yeah, we poll high over here as well, okay? And they would correctly perceive that liberals show this profile, okay? So what you have, as Haidt draws this out to a fine point, you have liberals operating with a false assumption of what the true values are of conservatives. And you have conservatives accurately perceiving the political terrain. So as Haidt said, it's not simply a matter of there being this disconnect taking place. It's almost a um, it's not that it's hard for liberals to win elections. He's sort of stunned that liberals win any elections, given that they're only playing with three of the six foundational values. So this is all taken out of chapter 8 of Hyde. I commend it to you. You can flip through it standing in a bookstore at an airport waiting to board if you need to take it in. So last point on this, let's come back to Frank, what's the matter with Kansas? And Haidt makes a convincing point that the urban legend that what happened in Kansas was that the manipulation of the media caused the blue-collar, white farm vote in Kansas to vote against their economic best interests of foreign policies and whatever, and they were bamboozled by, Karl Rove and Fox News or whatever to go vote Republican. And Haidt said no. What is going on, the alternate explanation according to Haidt, is that as you see the family farm attacked by the economic forces of big agriculture and economic depression and rising costs and the kids moving away and not coming back, okay, that's a moral value dealing with the traditions of a community. Okay, and to a certain extent, we saw the same thing in North Carolina in 2012, where there was a constitutional referendum put on the ballot during a primary season. It was a little bit somewhat skewed on marriage equality, or marriage should only be, Amendment 1, marriage should only be between a man and a woman. And it was passed a very low turnout, but 62% of the vote in favor of male-female marriage only. And what was heartbreaking to me as an old liberal was to see that in that cohort, the voting precincts that were African-American almost universally voted for that amendment. And, you go back and you look at, what is going on. And again, in a lot of communities, not just African American, but you have this concern about the community disappearing on that. So that's sort of that's the guts of Haidt. Scott, tell us about how to do better here.
I think there are a couple of nice things about Haidt. I want to say right off the bat, I think that we're going to continue to learn about this theory, and there's going to be some development and change. And I wouldn't take those sort of six dimensions as sort of written in stone. But they are really easy to understand, and they're very evocative. If we start thinking about it, they're very rich in thinking about how we do things differently. And they fit into what we already know about messaging. Right, which is that people, you always have to frame your message, you have to have stories, you have to be able to get people to understand that deep cause and effect that's going to drive their reasoning through a problem. Maybe the initial first important thing is to realize that most of the time we're not conscious of doing this. Right? So it starts with us becoming more conscious that we ourselves are not reasoning through to our moral beliefs, but we just jumped to a conclusion long ago and we stuck to it. Right. So first is introspection. So let's look at public health. If liberals are bad arguers, which is part of Haidt's story here, public health are the worst. People are the worst of the worst. Right. I like this because this is Lemuel Shattuck's pitch for a public health law, 150 years ago. And basically, if you read his arguments, they're just typical liberal public health arguments. It's going to prevent a lot of harm. It's going to make a lot of things better. It's going to take care of people who need to be taken care of. It's even when he talks about being moral, it pretty much comes back to avoiding harm, which is how we generally think. We tell people, look, there's 10,000 deaths from X. If we just do something about X, that's going to be 10,000 people alive. End of story. I'm going to sit down now. You just write the check. you know, we'll all be fine on that. There's no problem. You know, and if it's guns, it's, well, guns are killing people. Like, that's it. Right? They'll be just like, they're killing people. Like, why do I have to say this twice? People being killed. And yet you don't get it. What's wrong with you? You know, and I worked in harm reduction for many, many years, and, you know, that was the basic story of needle exchange. You know, we would say, like, if you give people needles, they won't get HIV and hepatitis, so they'll be saved. And people say, huh? You're going to give drug users needles? Yeah, because if you give them needles, they won't. But you're encouraging drug use, you know, which for a lot of people is a very unsanctity kind of thing. You know, people just think that's really bad. Like, it's actually probably better that you don't use the needle, and that, you know, and then we don't help you use the needle, we don't participate in that immoral activity. And we would just look at him like, are you crazy? Christy Todd Whitman, the old governor of New Jersey, was just a poster woman of people we hated because she shut down needle exchange in New Jersey and wouldn't listen. And we hated her even more because she said, you know, we're not going to expose our kids to any risk that they're going to be attracted to drug use, which, A, it was, you know, part of our harm story and why we like harm so much is we have evidence. It's so it's real. Like, our rational brains can point to something that tells you pretty reliably what the danger is and how to change it. And there wasn't much evidence that having a needle exchange in Trenton was going to take a lot of suburban kids from, you know, Princeton and turn them into heroin fiends. But if you now think of, now looking back on it, thinking of the slides that Jean showed, right, one of the things that's going on there is that she was having a loyalty reaction. Like, what needle exchange triggered in her was the thought of people like her, people in my group, people I'm responsible for, people that I care about, having trouble. And that's a non-starter, right? So she was over here and we were over here and we just weren't going to meet. Interestingly enough, during the overdose crisis, where so many of the people who've died have been white and not as poor as usual, and often those same kids that she wanted to keep away from the needles, it's been a very different reaction. The laws that are, for example, been passed to encourage or to make possible family members and friends and other drug users to carry the antidote for an opioid overdose have swept across the country in the last few years by huge majorities or unanimously passed. Red states, blue states haven't mattered at all because there was a different moral reaction generated. Right? This was about protecting us. This was about our group. And it led to a very different outcome. I'm not casting any aspersions on this. This is just an observation. Right? And I'm also not saying this is going to be easy. Right, because like any frame, I mean, it's actually not so easy to predict what moral intuition, what elephant reaction you will trigger. Right? You can try and frame an argument that you hope will trigger a reaction, but you never know. This is by no means clockwork. But what it does do is give us a couple of basic steps, you know, guidelines to think of after we have realized that our own beliefs are probably not as well thought out as we expected. Many of them are habitual. Many of them actually don't stand up to close observation, either internally, they just don't actually make sense in relation to the facts of the world, or they're incomplete. You know, we are not thinking about aspects of the sacred. And even liberals care about sanctity. You know, think about a dirty yoga mat. Or, as some very otherwise socially liberal people will feel, the ickiness and bodily invasion of vaccines. Right? There's liberal sanctity, too. So we can actually practice having a broader moral palate, even for ourselves. But once we've got that, when we're trying to persuade, we have to look at our audiences, our targets, and ask, where are they going to be coming from? What moral judgments are going to be ready to pop when they, you know, face the topic we're introducing? And how do we maybe speak to those in a way that gets their elephant, as Haidt says, to lean our way and to be ready to listen and not to alienate them, not to make them mad from the start, not to start this battle of press agents? Certainly for us, that means relying a lot less reflexively on the care harm, preventing harm mode, and the authority mode. You know, we know best. We're scientists. You should trust us. That's how the world works. But the second piece, which I think is the other side of that coin and our trying to reach out more, is also to be a lot more understanding, have a lot more empathy for the people that we're fighting with, to have more respect for them. You know, if you think about people who vote against their own interests, say, liberals who vote for higher progressive taxation, we pat them on the back. We say, oh, that's, you know, that's how we should be. We should pay more. We like to pay more of our share. That's good. We don't think they're idiots. But yet, if the Kansas farmer who believes that what's really important is that we cut the deficit and that we put more money into defense and that we encourage people to get up off their butts and do some work, that's what's going to make the country great. So they are willing to vote for people who are going to do that and make their life harder. We look at them as idiots. They are strong moral agents who are trying to do some good in the world, just like we are. And the hope of this work, right, is that while we live in a world in which a bunch of really increasingly inane political careerists yell at each other saying anything in order to get people angry and get them mobilized, beneath that is a whole population of people who actually kind of would like to work together, have a good hive, find solutions. And if we treat each other not as if we were merely the pawns of those politicians, but as serious moral agents trying to work our way through hard problems and give people a little slack for being different from us, we can get that conversation going and perhaps, you know, find out that most of the time, you know, for most of the kinds of problems we face, there's a whole lot of overlap. We can probably find a way.
Okay, let me first say that probably one of the most challenging opportunities I ever had was not trying to do that political run, although that kicked me in the butt. It was really hard, but actually coming out as a Republican in a DRPH class. So, you know, how on earth did someone that works for, thinks about, and has spent a lifetime on issues that are so near and dear to the heart of public health ever end up a Republican? Well, maybe that was because I sat around a few too many Sunday lunches with both sets of grandparents that had a lot of conversation. I got to hear both sides of what was going on because my grandmother was the chair of the Republican Party in that part of the state, and my grandfather on the other side was huge into the other political realm. And so I got to hear it firsthand, you know, from the start. And at the time that I was looking at this, it was probably the passion of my grandmother, just like most of you. Some of you will relate back to that. So just to come out to this group, okay? But we've got listed up here some points that I think are pretty important, and I'm a systems thinker. So when I think across the system of what motivates people, that's what generates who I am and what I am. And my actual reason for running for the 50th District Senate seat was based on care and fairness. And so here I am, you know, looking at what was going on. I was advocating for adolescent pregnancy prevention efforts. I was advocating for a lot of the youth issues that needed to be addressed, and many other public health issues. And looking at the people that were in that part of rural Appalachia, western North Carolina, and going to the elected officials that were currently seated in those seats, trying to get them to do what needed to be done, and they happened to be on the Democrat ticket. So there needed to be someone to run against the person that was there that was not doing anything about the issue of 110 per thousand pregnant teenagers in western North Carolina.
Republican.
I was on that side. He was not doing anything about what was needing to be done. So I remember saying to him, and it was a rash moment, if you don't do something, I'm going to run against you. And that was a rash moment because I had to get through a Republican primary, and that was no easy thing. But looking at it, trying to frame it from that perspective, I think my systems thinking spilled over even to this thing because I've been focused on getting together everything I needed except my registration for the conference. So, you know, looking at all of those things and looking across that moral matrix that was up there previously, I think it is pretty easy to focus in on some of the things with our conservative constituents that we try to work with. Too often we go into the battle just as though it is a battle instead of looking for what it is common. Because let me tell you, there is a lot more common than there is that is uncommon. Having a little bit of empathy and thinking deeper about what is happening in the community that you're addressing, you know, sometimes people don't know. And, you know, we've talked before about doing research on the people that you're speaking to that are elected and are the decision makers for these different issues. And there's almost always someone that is very close to them that is being impacted by something that you are addressing. That's your job to figure that out. That's your job to listen. We go in with such a pre-planned, effective, an efficient kind of strategy about what is right, framed much in the, as Scott mentioned a minute ago, with all of those really good reasons, with all the science in the world, and we're not effective because we're not listening and we're not allowing ourselves to adapt to what we're hearing. And without allowing yourself to adapt your frame, you're never going to have success with someone that perceives public health. I mean, they hear public health and they think we're going to be where we are, but we can't figure out how to get to where they are. So I was looking at the public health issues recently. I have opportunity regularly to interface with our Republican governor because my health department is seated in the capital city of Raleigh. And one of the state deputy directors called me and said, hey, the governor's wanting his flu shot. Can you come over and do his flu shot? And I thought, heck yeah, I'll go give him his flu shot. You know, I'm a nurse, and it's going to be a good chance for me to hit on a couple of the points that I needed to make. And so when I went in, I walked in and, you know, I set everything up the way that you're supposed to with the sterile drapes and, you know, maintaining everything that we needed to do the vaccine. And I told him, I said, okay, so before I give this, these are the forms that you must check. You must answer questions about, you know, all of these different factors, and you must sign this. And I said, also, you need to understand, since I'm here, you know, I'm going to educate you on something public health. And I stressed, you know, why flu vaccine was important. But however, there is no funding for flu vaccine other than for the free vaccine for children and pregnant women in our state. And I said, there are a lot of others that need it, but there is no free funding. There's no funding for those vaccines. So we are limited in some of our outreach because people must pay with their benefits or cash. So which would you rather pay? And he smiled at me and says, I get your point, okay? But it was an excellent opportunity for education. And I had to frame it in such a way that, you know, I could have been really ugly about it. But, you know, it was the thing to do. And I could have walked in just quietly, given him the vaccine out of what our health department had to purchase, and never said anything. But no, it was a good opportunity. It was a good public health education opportunity. But I would challenge you to really think on this part of what we have discussed. about how there is a different framework that you need to approach your conversations. How even digging deep within yourself, understanding what is motivating you, what are you being righteous about? We all are. Okay,
we've said nothing provocative. No. So questions, comments, whatever. Start over here.
So can you give some examples? Maybe you did a message, you know, where you're using the context of loyalty and sanctity to frame a public health issue?
Sure. I mean, Sue and I did one of these a month ago with Gary Gunderson in Winston-Salem. It was a state public health training. And he is comes out of the Carter Center. He holds a joint faculty position at Wake Forest University in divinity and public health. And he's really sort of one of the leading people on faith-based health programs. And so I think, to me, and I'll ask Scott or Sue and either one to come in, but on the sanctity issue, public health, I think liberals tend to think, wait a minute, sanctity, religion, we don't do that, you know, separation of church and state. And Hyde does a good job of talking about the human condition, and we certainly believe in that. And if there's anything that public health is strong in, it is our concern for the human condition, the transient nature of our existence here. We all believe in that at one point or another, or we wouldn't be in the field to begin with. So part of it is take the blinders off on that. And then on the loyalty issue, part of that gets into the, you know, what domain are we talking about? You know, are you a Chicago Bears fan? Are you, you know, a member of your local community or whatever? You know, there are all these concentric Venn diagram overlapping rings. And that becomes a challenge for us of who we're loyal to. But that's two. Sue, you want to just stand up and speak up?
Yeah, I'll give you a very concrete example of one that, you know, with the Republican majority.
With a Republican majority in our General Assembly, some of the conversation around funding for some of our reproductive health, long-acting birth control, and different things like that arose. So to take a very specific example of how I framed discussion to help that conservative lean understand why that was important to fund, I took the perspective of the numbers that I had that showed the reduction in teen pregnancy and the reduction in abortions. Okay? If you have long-acting birth control, you are dealing with fewer. And if that's something that is valued by a particular conservative group, they get that. Hey, by doing this, and I could show them statistically how much we had reduced by using this form of birth control. So, I mean, that's a real particular type of an example.
Okay. But partly, you know, again, I think we already sort of know how to do this, and we do it sort of naturally, so part of this is being a little bit conscious and then thinking about how you might massage that and develop a campaign. So look at vaccination. You know, we are making loyalty arguments as much or more than harm arguments, because we're pointing to those people who are free riding and cheating, right? Not just to the fact that they'll be harmed. So that's an example of doing that there. I think I've talked about the drug use in the naloxone one. To me, what happened in part is that for some reason, and then this is something maybe we could do better at, when we talked about giving needles to drug users to prevent them from getting infected with the virus, it did not trigger any great sense of the sanctity of life. But when you talk about our kids dying of overdoses. People right away, and it's like, we got to protect life at all. We can't worry about this other stuff. We can't worry about whether we're encouraging. It's like, we got to save these lives. So you think about those sorts of reactions, you got to pay attention to that and then say, well, all right, how do we get more of the sanctity of life into this story?
Go ahead.
In one of those surprising coincidences in life, I finished reading this book last Thursday for book club, and we loved it. And just in those few days I've been reading it, it's changed how I view the news. But I think one of the arguments, or one of the things he says in the book, is that although conservative care about care and preventing harm, it's not to the same level. So that's the one that they're willing to sacrifice, is their competing interest. So how does that work if that's the liberals', most favorite?
Well, see, I think it's important not to think of these as sort of dichotomous. What happens is you get a reaction, and if you don't watch out, that reaction just becomes it. But if you can get a conversation going, then what happens is you have the opportunity to get people to move across in their thinking about this, and so you can invoke, because I don't think that Chrissy Todd Whitman didn't care if, black kids died, if drug users died. She cared. She didn't think that was good, but she had got sort of focused in on one thing. So we want to open this up.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of it, just going back to the that combined slide, part of it is a revelation to me that conservatives do value care, liberty, and fairness. It is not the reciprocal of the liberal curve over there, where we liberals clearly give short shrift to loyalty, authority, and sanctity. And looking at my own self, how can we shape? I think there's powerful sanctity arguments embedded in public health and loyalty arguments. We are loyal to those communities. I mean, community-based public health is exactly that, And we don't think of how to fit that in with the what's going on in this community, what's going on in Kansas, what's going on to the African-American communities in North Carolina, and the decreasing middle class, and all those other issues to appeal to. Anyway, in the back.
In the context of this discussion, where does the economic benefit kind of measure fit into this discussion?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there, once you're talking about costs and benefits, it turns out we probably don't have too strong a moral reaction to that at all. That's the kind of thing that you can talk about once you get the elephant to lean. And it's the kind of thing that will not influence an elephant at all if that's the argument you start with.
Another thought there is that, there's the saying health is wealth, and without health it doesn't matter for the other components. So looking at that and framing that in the context of without appropriately addressing some of the issues, that's exactly why our Medicaid dollars are going through the roof, our Medicare dollars are going through the roof. So giving very concrete examples, I don't think you can just talk in theory. You've got to dig deep into what you know motivates and then give them something that helps them understand that. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, because some of the money, depending upon what the money or the support is for, that may vary. But there's an ability to link it in a smart way. As a matter of fact, I think public health is not. We're not doing such a grand job there. We're not talking across the different systems the way we should to impact health. My roots as a nurse, nurses are highly motivated patient advocates. Very. We don't make more money if we help our patients get well or if they stay sick. It doesn't change. But that it does for a lot of the health systems, and that's why we're in this dilemma that we're in today. So looking at pure outcomes and framing that appropriately.
Yeah, if you go back to Thomas Frank, What's the Matter with Kansas? See, that was the paradox he was laying out, that the economic benefit, the economic equity issues that the Democrats had been phrasing, you know, since World War II, or maybe really since the New Deal, appealed to the economic self-interest of the Kansas farmers. But they got their clocks cleaned because there was a deeper issue dealing with the vanishing culture of the community. And so I think that's one of the keys in the economic benefit that we fly over sometime, is that what is it doing to the community? What is it doing to the white farmers in Kansas, or the African American, or any middle, or the middle class, you know? But it goes to that overriding value of the preservation of the moral community and the traditions.
Just one last thing, because this is such an important point. There is some, and some of these have already been broken down by Hike, but there's a difference between thinking of fairness as equality of opportunity and fairness as equity of outcome. And one of the things that happens when we talk about economic arguments is that we sometimes cross those two. So you'll say to somebody in Kansas, you know, we're going to take money from the taxes of the people who make more, and we're going to give some of that money to you. And we think, like, that's an unbeatable bargain. You're going to be lifted up, and you're going to have a better outcome. But the farmer may think, wait a minute, you just stole money from that guy. I don't want stolen money. You know, so they're thinking, like, as long as I have an opportunity to play here, I don't want to take. So we have that kind of problem. You know, people really do hear these things so differently that unless you're really conscious of that, your snam bang argument falls flat. Yeah.
There's a group that I'm working with in a community, undocumented immigrants, and the argument that I hear a lot is that immigration is great because that's our country, but people broke the law. You know, it's all this thing about the law being broken. And then I have to present the argument that, you know, people are breaking the law in a lot of different ways all the time. Taxes, you know, how they do their taxes, you know, how they try to get away with vehicles, you know, doing things with their vehicles, driving too fast, and so on. So people are breaking the law in a lot of different ways on pretty much a constant basis. And so somehow the two don't seem to jive in a person's mind about breaking the law. Because that seems to be the excuse, or I shouldn't say that, but that seems to be the rationale, which is kind of flimsy in a lot of ways, in terms of, so how do you deal with that kind of
Well, this is one reason why this psychology stuff is so interesting for us when we think about persuasion, because that's an example of the phenomenon that Daniel Kahneman calls what you see is all there is. If you're presented with a situation, you will fill that situation in really richly. And you'll think about that illegal alien breaking the law. I mean, if it's sort of primed that way and you're primed to think that way, you'll go down that path. And you will not think about all the other instances in which people break the law, and we don't think of that as being the worst thing in the world. We don't castigate speeders or, you know, litter bugs and stuff. We don't say, well, you have to leave the country. But we don't think that because we've been primed to think about this, and that's all we see. And in fact, this is also a good example of how very good persuaders can use pretty subtle things like starting to call people who used to be called, you know, undocumented people, or, you know, start calling them illegal immigrants. Hammer home that illegality and try and trigger the authority dimension, right? To get people to just see this is a law breaking, it's complete, and then they move to unfairness, like other people line up, but these people cheated. And then once that's the story, we're not going to be able to break through to those people because they've had that reaction, they've made their conclusion. It's going to be very, their elephant is steaming down the path that way. And so, you know, a lot of what we do, thinking long term, is we got to try and create stories about big issues that trigger different moral intuitions so that we can have a different conversation and have a different collection of stories guiding people's reasoning and discussion.
One piece out of the deeper story that height is driving us towards on this issue of lawbreakers and undocumented aliens, etc., is look what he says about what is really going on. It's the preservation of the institutions and traditions of a moral community. Okay? So a way of getting out of the authority issue is how is this going to impact our community? And one door that is just sitting right there is sanctity, you know, the faith community. And churches and religious organizations taking in refugees, aliens, undocumented, the whole piece. And you come up with a different conversation. But like Kahneman would say, if you're all it is what you see, that's all you see on that. I think we've probably got time for one more question here.
Thank you. Just to elaborate on something I wanted to ask. Two things. First of all, whether the fairness was actually the same kind of
Okay. All right. The question is two parts, authority and fairness. And is fairness the same? So, Lynn, I'll let you determine whether fairness is the same for conservatives as liberals. On the authority, it's really public health is firmly schizophrenic on the authority issue. Okay? Jacobson v. Massachusetts, you will have your smallpox vaccine or you will pay the fine. Still good law 110 years later. Okay? We are part of an authoritarian regime. Okay? We are part of the government. We kind of got real creepy about that during Vietnam, I guess, you know. But we are a police power function. It is there. I don't know that we need to flex it too much, but we should not shy away from it. Okay? So that's the authority piece. So Lynn, you want to take what is a conservative view of fairness?
Fairness, I think when you're looking at it, it really is very dependent upon whatever that specific issue is. And you know that. So walking into it, understanding from a fairness perspective, we have a lot of extremes on both sides, conservative, liberals. We have what we perceive to be fair. But when touched with the reality of another framework, perhaps it's the care, or perhaps it's the authority, pairing with that, it then makes for a more potent argument or factoid that you can share. So looking at those kinds of things, you know, I get into discussions very regularly with, it may be something as rabies. It may be HIV isolation quarantine or violations, and it may be Ebola quarantine. So fairness in one question, you have to think across the framework of how you put that into the context of those other factors, because there's an equal, sometimes, point that needs to be made almost simultaneously. Maybe it is the authority one. Maybe it is whatever.